Welcome to Vocal Point. This is Jerry Newcomb. Recently, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was asked if he believed in evolution. His evasive answer kind of got him in trouble with the politically correct crowd. Well, that's just one example of how evolution is promoted dogmatically by the elites in our culture. Even though I'm not aware of any evidence for macroevolution, there is abundant evidence for microevolution, small, tiny changes within kinds, but the missing links are still missing, as far as I understand it. Joining us now to talk about the impact of Darwin on our culture in general is Dr. John West, Vice President of the Discovery Institute and the author of Darwin Day in America. John says, we have a problem where too often science has been replaced by scientism. We suffer from quote-unquote totalitarian science. Dr. West, welcome back to Vocal Point.
Jerry, thanks for having me again.
Sure. So what is science versus scientism?
Yeah, you know, science, I want to make clear, I think is a very good and wonderful thing. It's a great effort to understand the natural world, and from many of its insights, we create wonderful inventions and things. But scientism is the effort to apply science really outside its rightful sphere, really basically as a trump card in whatever you're discussing, whether it be religion, ethics, rights of conscience, public policy.
The weather.
Really, the weather, yes.
That's true.
It is. And so it's really applying it outside its proper sphere, basically to be the final answer for everything.
Well, and it's one particular interpretation of it. If we were talking about the truth, you know, that which could be verified, okay, fine. But we're talking about something that, is an interpretation and sometimes an extrapolation from, you know, maybe based on some evidence, but not the full picture.
Well, that's a really good point, because a lot of the so-called science disputes are, in fact, disputes over interpretation of the same evidence, or sometimes people suppress evidence. And so you're exactly right. In addition to applying science outside the spheres that it was intended, there's also debates over science need to be open-minded and not dogmatic and open to criticism. And really, too often when we discuss science disputes in public today, it's sort of, if you don't have the view that sort of the elite has, therefore you can't even raise questions.
Yeah.
And the people who have the majority view don't even deign to have to provide answers. I mean, you mentioned the weather, and of course the whole issue of climate change is a really good example of that. Whatever your views on climate change happen to be, and my own views are somewhat over the map on it, I don't have really hard considered views. I'd like to see the evidence. Too often in that debate, you have some people saying, well, you know, it's so beyond dispute, we don't even have to answer your questions or your objections, and how dare you even raise those things. Even if you happen to be a professor at MIT with equal credentials to me, you don't have the right to raise those questions, and I don't have to answer. And I think that is a totalitarian mindset. No one has the right, especially when they're asking, when we're debating how to spend billions of dollars and what laws will be passed and what impacts our daily lives, no one has the right to simply declare, you know, this is our view, and we don't even have to respond rationally or provide the evidence on which our views are based.
Okay, you earned a PhD. What is your particular focus or specialty within science?
Yeah, actually, I'm not a scientist. I'm a social scientist. So my PhD is in government, and I have a particular interest in the history and current application of science in public policy. And one of my points is that as soon as you start talking about what the government should or shouldn't do, mm-hmm. and what your neighbors can and can't do, and what you spend taxpayer money on, that's no longer just a scientific question.
Right. Okay, good point.
It's also a public policy question. So lots of different people should have the right to engage in that discussion. And again, in climate change, even in Christian spheres, I have to tell you, recently I have been involved in arranging for some lectures by someone who has a dissenting view on some climate change issues. And I have to admit my sadness to find that even in the Christian community, at Christian colleges and churches and others, that this particular person has a background in public policy, ethics, and seminary, and he talks about some of the broader ethical issues. basically some people on the other side saying, well, he doesn't even have the right to speak because he's not a scientist. Well, a lot of the questions discussed about climate change actually involve ethics. Is it, if you're going to spend $1 billion, for example, are you helping people more by spending it on climate change, or if that $1 billion were to go to provide cleaner water in Africa? Well, that raises ethical issues and public policy questions. It's not just a question about the science. And so it's not just the scientists who have the right to determine what we do on that.
Good point. How about your response to that Scott Walker issue or example?
Well, you know, in defense of Scott Walker, he was in England for, I believe, a trade trip for his state. And he basically said, you know, I'm not going to be pontificating on other matters. And so I actually think his response was a good response for where it was. Now, overall, I think a lot of politicians are, especially in the Republican Party, tend to be way too afraid of answering the question about evolution. And maybe it's because they don't know anything, but I think more is they're paranoid that the elites will attack them. Well, you know, so what? 70 to 80% of voters, according to polls, do not agree with the sort of unguided Darwinian mindset. And they also believe that they think that students should learn both the scientific evidence for and against Darwin's theory. So it really isn't, I think, the thing that is most troubling or most, disturbing or head-scratching is how many politicians think that somehow this is politically controversial among voters to, say, defend something like that students should be able to learn all the scientific evidence on the topic, both for and against. That's supported by, according to opinion polls, by Democrats, by whites, blacks, you know, whatever subgroup you want to look at, that's overwhelmingly supported. So this shouldn't take a lot of political courage in order to make that point.
Well, I remember when Ronald Reagan was president and he had made some sort of reference to evolution, you know, basically kind of questioning it beyond a theory, you know, as a theory and so forth. And, you know, next thing you know it, all these different scientists were intoning. And in fact, there was a fellow that Dan Rather had on who said something like there were 100 million fossils cataloged in the, you know, museums all around the world. Those 100 million fossils are all evidence for evolution. So what is Ronald Reagan talking about? You know, this dumb politician. And that, by the way, just that remark alone on Dan Rather's broadcast spurred a man who's not even a Christian, but his name was William Fix, and he decided to write a book in the 1980s called The Bone Peddlers. I don't know if you ever saw the book or heard about it, but he was basically saying, you know, wow, I mean, he doesn't agree with the creationists and he doesn't agree with the evolutionists, the dogmatic, but he's saying, look, you can't say all these different fossils do point to evolution.
Well, and I just point out that in that case, that really hurt Ronald Reagan. I guess, you know, he was only elected to one term, right? So he had the usual Darwin amen chorus attacking him. You know, so what? But again, really all what I would suggest a political candidate do is, I mean, there are a few things. You raised at the top of the program, one thing, evolution means a lot of different things. You know, do you believe in microevolution? Do you believe in common ancestry of everything, which is controversial even among evolutionists now? Do you believe that it's an unguided, unplanned process, which a lot of Darwinian scientists believe, but a lot of other people don't? And so, you know, to ask that question itself needs to be unpacked. But I think, you know, all a politician really needs to say is, look, first of all, I think it's good for them to say that a president is not the head of the school board for the nation. And so this should be determined by parents, local, first of all by parents, but then second of all by, you know, local education agencies and then by states, not by the national government. And I think one of the bad things of the former George W. Bush administration was that they so tried to get the federal government involved in local education, which I think is a fiasco. But then point two, they could say as a matter of principle, science shouldn't be taught dogmatically. And, you know, I think that that students, you know, shouldn't be studying religion in science classes, but they should be studying the, you know, all the scientific evidence, including, you know, the evidence that's critical of theories like Darwinian theory. And so that, because that's something that actually, that's a common ground policy that the vast majority of Americans of whatever walk of life actually support. And I think it's too bad when too many politicians allow themselves to be put in a corner, and they really answer questions based off of the agenda of the reporter rather than reframing the issue. The issue, no one that I know of, whether it be creationist, intelligent design supporter, or anyone else, is actually advocating that in public schools you be teaching Genesis. For one reason, in the Puget Sound region, I wouldn't want teachers teaching that because most of them probably don't have the religious beliefs I have, and the last thing I want is for them to be teaching the Bible because it won't come out how, you know, I would like. But they are advocating that, you know, students need to know what's actually being debated by the scientists. Mm-hmm. As you point out, you know, a lot of the fossil things are disputed even among evolutionists. And it's just papered over in the textbooks.
Yeah.
It's not in the scientific literature. Students should know that. Right now, there are lots of self-proclaimed evolutionists who don't think that natural selection and random mutation can actually do the stuff that, you know, orthodox Darwinian theory thought. And so they're scrambling for some other explanation. They can't come to a general conclusion on that, but they are clear that the current, you know, claim that natural selection and random mutations, they're clear that that won't cut it. Well, why? What's the crime for students knowing about that?
Mm-hmm. So in other words, what you're saying is that...
You're either for pushing religion down other people's throats, or you're for science with a capital S. And that is such a false choice.
Right.
And the most discouraging thing is when politicians actually answer questions as if they think that that's the choice that's being presented, and it's not. And the most effective thing they could do is to push back on it and say, that's a false choice.
Yeah, good point. And also, I think it's important to realize that, and you've said this as such, but I just want to say it this way, which is that if you're going to teach Darwinism and evolution and so forth, and that ought, you know, that has its place, of course, but you got to teach the full picture, which is all the holes in the theory. You've got to teach about the Cambrian explosion, which shows life, you know, the light, nothing happens, then all of a sudden, bam, you have this whole explosion of life in the fossil record. And let me ask you this, Dr. West, can you name one fossil that you're aware of, one fossil anywhere that points to evolution in progress? The best example ever was a Piltdown man, but that turned out to be a deliberate fraud, a deliberate hoax, a deliberate, make-believe thing. It wasn't real.
Well, I mean, that dealt with human evolution. In fairness to the people who support Darwin's theory, they will cite, you know, they have hundreds of things that they will cite. The thing is, if you actually look in more depth in most, if not all of them, they themselves aren't in general agreement on them. So you are right that this idea that there are these wonderful, you know, there is a wonderful fossil record, but it's a fragment, and it doesn't really show a lot of the things that some of them, you know, claim. Sometimes it's like the less evidence they have, the more dogmatic their statements, and I think that's partly to cover up just how little evidence they have. But, you know, they will cite things, I mean, like progression in dealing with whales, they'll cite, again, there are loads of problems with these things, and even among evolutionary biologists that they don't agree. But, you know, they have lots of things that they'll cite. And with regard to human evolution, you know, every year or two there's a new, supposed link or ancestor. Now, within a year or two, usually they are not even accepted by many evolutionists, but, you know, they'll come up with new things.
So, in other words, like, for example, there was a lemur that was highly touted just about 2 or 3 years ago, but an ancient lemur. But the bottom line is, it's kind of like these things ultimately become, especially in the example of man and apes, that ultimately we see that these particular fossils, it's either a man or it's an ape, you know, it's one or the other. And you don't have, in other words, the ape men. And when you gave that example about whales, a progression in the whales, but you start with a whale, you have a whale in the middle, and you end up with a whale at the end. And to me, the key word is kinds. And then I get that word from the Bible where it says God made these different species according to their kinds. But that's what I see the line as being. You don't have one kind becoming another kind that I know of.
Yeah, well, the only reason I brought up whales is that has been the more recent poster child for you have these creatures on land, and then or maybe it was the other way around. I can't always keep it straight. But and then they became whales or vice versa over time. But even in that sequence that has been highlighted as one of the best preserved sequences, there is so much debate among evolutionists about how you get there. And then, let alone the fossils themselves, let's just be clear. Even if you had a perfect set of fossils, this is just logic 101, that showed these different forms that you could put in a sequence, that actually doesn't tell you anything about whether those sequences are related or whether they were, you know, separate to begin with, or if they were part of a larger sequence of basically a transformation over time with descent with modification. The fossils themselves can't tell you that. And it's somewhat arbitrary how you put them in sequence. And some evolutionists are fairly open about this, at least among themselves. So logically, you need a lot of other evidence, like genetic and other evidence, that doesn't actually track. And then you also need a mechanism that can actually do it. I mean, if you actually compare the closest thing on land to a whale and a whale, the sorts of things that need to be re-engineered. And one of my friends, biologist Richard Sternberg, gives a great lecture on this. I mean, from the way you reproduce, to which in water is quite different than, you know, the sexual reproduction system of how it can exist on land. I mean, structural, huge engineering changes. And so you can't just have a sequence of fossils and say, oh, well, see, they just jumped between, they descended with modification. You actually need a biological mechanism that can engineer those changes. And I'm sorry, the evidence for natural selection acting on random variation doesn't cut it. The best case for natural selection is actually in at the microbe level, you know, among bacteria. Experiments have been done in real time where you actually have population sizes of hundreds of thousands and generation times that are just in the hours. And so you can actually model what natural selection can do. And you know what the experiments show? Not much.
Hmm.
I mean, you really, once you have to accumulate more than a couple mutations, it basically, you get dead things or less functional things. These aren't going to be things that natural selection can actually choose. When you're talking about things that are going to need hundreds of mutations to get some of these new structures, this is just really preposterous. So even if you have the perfect sequence of fossils, which they don't, that doesn't give you a mechanism of how you get to each of those things on the sequence.
And let me say something that would sound like heresy in modern ears, or many modern ears, but honestly, a worldwide flood, around the whole globe, capturing and, you know, encasing all these different organisms, burying them very quickly, I think that would definitely change our understanding and interpretation of the fossil record if you thought about it that, using that as a potential hypothesis. But I throw that out there for what it's worth. This is Focal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Our guest right now is Dr. John West, who's the vice president of the Discovery Institute. He's the author of Darwin Day in America. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure. It really is a history of the impact of what might be called social Darwinism. And a lot of people think Darwin's theory is just something you debate in academia. It doesn't really impact you or me. But that's not true, and so it goes through really a lot of the things that people don't know about and they should know about, the history of eugenics, forced sterilization, all sorts of things that were done largely on behalf of evolutionary biologists and leading scientists, and how it impacted our view of sexuality and family, education, economics, and bioethics. And so in the new edition, which just came out, I also have a whole new chapter just devoted to the last several years. It's called Scientism in the Age of Obama and Beyond. So,
Okay, for those not familiar with it, what is eugenics? And explain about Margaret Sanger.
Oh, yes. Well, eugenics was the effort to basically breed a better race. And the insight came from Darwin himself in a book called The Descent of Man, where he basically noted that civilized societies, by being compassionate, we were counteracting natural selection or the survival of the fittest by, as he put it, inoculating people against smallpox, saving the poor, or helping the poor, saving the sick. In his view, we were helping people that nature would have killed off. And so if our creator really is not God, it is this blind process of survival of the fittest. By counteracting it, we're going to destroy our race. Now, Darwin was personally compassionate, so he said, oh, we really can't counteract this because that would be incompassionate. But, you know, he's just laid out that if we keep being compassionate, we're going to destroy the human race. So his disciples basically said, well, you know, we can't do that. So we need to find a way. We either need to go back to the law of the jungle and let people, you know, die off, and they thought that was not compassionate, like Darwin. So, or you need to reinstitute something like natural selection that mimics it, and through eugenics. So this was a crusade to people who were thought to be evolutionarily unfit. Largely, these were because of their race, or in some cases, you know, there were dyslexia patients, or you know, people who had learning disabilities. I mean, there were a variety of reasons that they regard them as evolutionarily unfit. And so then they would try to legally compel them to be sterilized so they couldn't have children and damage the gene pool. And we, in America, sterilized something like 50, 60,000 people against their will because of this. In Germany, they did several hundred thousand. Of course, they went beyond that and actually started killing the who they regarded as the handicapped. But so eugenics, though, wasn't just in Germany. It was in the United States.
Are you saying that the origins, the genesis of the Holocaust was Darwin's theory, ultimately?
Well, I don't like to put it that way.
Well,
way. Let me put it this way. Darwin himself, I think, would have been appalled personally by what happened in the Holocaust. So I don't want to it is true to say, and I would say, that it is certainly true that Hitler and National Socialists, as a key part of their justification and rhetoric, was a very vigorous form of social Darwinism that basically said that the unfit were not worthy of life, and that if we weren't going to go back to the law of natural selection itself, we had to reinstitute something like that. And so that certainly was part of their ideology, and that is unquestionable. I mean, there is no rational question about that. It's there in their writings. And anyone who doubts that should read the two books by historian Richard Weikart. And in fact, it goes
from Darwin to Hitler.
From Darwin to Hitler and Hitler's ethic. And it goes well before Hitler, though. In the end of the 19th century, the German social Darwinism even predates Hitler and the National Socialists in Germany. So it certainly was part of it. Now, that's different than saying Darwin is responsible. You know, people... Darwin was personally kindly. Now, I think a more interesting question is, if you really have the Darwinian view, where that the only way reason humans are at the top of the food chain, as it were, is because of this blind, vicious process of survival of the fittest. It's not because we were designed that way by some beneficent creator. If that's your view of how human beings progressed, and that if we counteract it, we're going to destroy ourselves, it seems to me that it is somewhat logical and rational within that way of thinking mm-hmm. to maybe you know not go the full route of the Hitlerites, but certainly to try to get rid of the unfit either by forced sterilization to prevent future unfit or something like that. And also, if you have a Darwinian view, Darwin also wrote about his view of ethics. The ethics evolve over time, basically on behalf of survival of the fittest. So in other words, that which helps you survive and reproduce and flourish, that's what helps determine what your ethics are in any given time. And, you know, there is no transcendent, trans-historical set of right or wrong. If that's your view of ethics, then I'd say you know, whether you're personally kindly or not, you've really removed the objective basis for criticizing people who go down the route of eugenics. Mm. And again, that's not to say that, you know, Darwin himself would have been happy with Hitler. No, I don't think he was. I think he was better than his theory. But once you've have an evolutionary view of ethics, it is pretty hard to start saying that some of these things are wrong, especially, I mean, the only way you could say it is wrong is you're saying, well, it's not effective in actually in reducing the unfit, or you know, it's not effective to the goals that you're setting.
And as Dostoevsky said, if there is no God, then everything is permissible because there's nobody to hold us accountable. He who has the power has the right. You know, might makes right. Truly. Dr. West, what else do you talk about in Darwin Day in America?
Well, you know, one of the big areas of impact is human sexuality and family life. And there is a big push. I mean, it probably goes back to the evolutionary zoologist named Alfred Kinsey. Most people know that Kinsey's approach to sexuality helped open the doors to the sexual revolution.
Kinsey's the man who ruined America.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. He's one of the men. But most people don't know that Kinsey's background was an evolutionary zoologist. That's how he was trained at Harvard. And so his approach, and that's key to understanding what he was trying to do, in his sort of Darwinian approach, basically if you find it anywhere in nature, it's equally natural. And he reduced human sexuality to what he said was normal mammalian behavior, by which he meant if you could find a mammal anywhere doing something, then it was equally natural with everything else, and therefore, you know, that was his standard for ethics. And, you know, Kinsey was tremendous.
The law of the jungle.
It is, but but it's even more so today. Just within the last 2 or 3 years, there was a best-selling book called Sex at Dawn by two evolutionary psychologists, where their argument is now marriage has to be redefined yet again. Of course, it's being redefined all sorts of ways, but what they're calling for is that it shouldn't be monogamous. Because why? Well, evolution bred us basically to have multiple partners, and so it is utterly unrealistic to expect a man and a wife to be faithful to each other, and we need to redefine marriage because of evolution, this is their argument, in order to involve as many partners as, you know, whichever partner wants, and that the, you know, you can be married to someone else, but then you can have lots of other partners, and you have to do that because that's how evolution bred us, that's how natural selection bred us, and this is a best-selling book by two evolutionary psychologists just in the last 2 or 3 years. This, again, if you don't think that the debate over evolution matters to you, you're wrong.
Boy,
it does.
You're absolutely right. Okay, what would you like to say in conclusion, Dr. John West of the Discovery Institute?
Well, I hope, especially if people don't think that this debate matters, that they'll get my book, Dark Day in America.
Would that be discovery.org?
Yeah, or even they could go to the book's website, DarwinDayInAmerica.com.
Okay.
DarwinDayInAmerica.com. But I think overall, I just hope that people would, what is it, that they would raise their baloney meter. When they have people who are making dogmatic claims in the name that science with a capital S says this, therefore, you're stupid even if you raise questions, that when they hear that sort of rhetoric, they would take a pause and say, that's ridiculous. They don't have the right to claim that. And, you know, I want to hear the evidence. And they don't have the right just to shut people down just because, you know, they happen to be a scientist, for example. That's abusing science. And I just hope that people, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, politicians or lay people or pastors, would get in the habit of being have a little more healthy skepticism of claims made in the name of science. Not be anti-science. Science is a wonderful thing. I think it's a God-given intellectual enterprise. But to be skeptical of some of the claims made in the name of science.
Excellent point. Thank you so much, Dr. West. Again, the name of the book is Darwin Day in America. The website, DarwinDayInAmerica.com. Thank you and all the best.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.